Colorado. Check out their website at www.alternativeradio.org. Coming up on CQT is Drama Text, an hour of spoken word recordings, and we'll get to it after a bit of station business. Till next week.
What's the matter? Is everything all right? That's okay. I've got just the right thing for you. CKUT 90.3 FM.
Vaccination against COVID-19 is ongoing throughout Quebec. The combined effect of two doses ensures better efficacy of the vaccine, reducing the risk of getting and transmitting the virus. You'll also stay protected for a longer period of time. Coming to your appointment for the second dose of the vaccine is a must, whatever else is on your schedule. The second dose of vaccine is essential. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
CKUT 90.3 FM.
Hello to all and welcome to Pirate Block Radio here on CKUT 90.3 FM with me, your host, Malte Leander. Pirate Block Radio is a show focusing on new media art and related artistic expression of different kinds. Coming out of Jejage, also known as Montreal, located on unceded Indigenous lands. We are currently in midsummer heat with everything seemingly moving slightly slower under the sun. But that doesn't mean that we are coming to a stop. On the contrary, a lot of interesting stuff is happening in and around Eastern Bloc this summer. At the time of speaking, the 11th edition of the festival Sight and Sound have just launched, with the complete programmation available online all summer long until the 31st of August. A fully packed lineup not to miss, curated by Irandi Verjara and Tina Sarlander. So head on over to the website sightandsound.online to enjoy the full range of artworks. And now that we are on the topic of the Sight and Sound Festival, we can also talk a little bit about today's Pirate Block Radio show. Today we are digging into the archives, playing segments from past episodes of previous years. And starting off, we'll listen to an interview with Pamela Tudge from the 7th edition of Sight and Sound back in 2017 on the theme of that year, non-compliant futures.
So I just want to welcome Pamela Tudge to Pirate Block Radio. She's going to present a workshop at Sight and Sound this year, and she's an artist who works with nutrition and food and
speculative art and critical design.
Speculative art and critical design.
Speculative critical design. There's a lot of new books on that. Like, okay. The whole concept around critical design processes and speculative art as the solution to everything. Yeah. Every book is the solution to everything. I just need to do this. That will be fine.
That's all I need to do.
Yeah.
Amazing. I mean, I think that's what specifically this innovation idea and the propaganda of innovation plays exactly with what you were talking about. So it's super interesting. I'm really looking forward to the festival and like having all these conversations around.
Yeah, I think it's a disinnovation, and I love that title, because I think, like, just on a side note, like, where I came from was, you know, I was at environmental studies, and I was, in BC, I was doing these things that wouldn't fit into the necessary, like, the science innovation, right? But I got a job for 3 years at McGill, which I don't know if I mentioned this before, and I was leading these, like, science panels, and, like, climate change, like, information, and, like, geospatial web technologies, and we were working with NASA and all this kind of stuff, and we were writing big reports of, like, you know, what's happening in the Arctic with climate change, and, like, really good information, like, great information, and you're just like, and, you know, there's a whole bunch of scientists that were writing the report to go to. Harper was in at the time. Most of our funding was coming from the federal government, and they were like, yeah, climate change, done somewhere, we heard about that. Fundamentally don't believe in it because we believe in, whatever Harper believed in, which actually was really weird when we got into it. Anyway, so, I was like, okay, and they just kept talking about innovation at McGill. Like, McGill was run on this whole concept of innovation, and you were just like, you're like, seriously, we're just producing more statistics and, like, coming up with different ways of viewing the same concept. And to some degree, it was interesting, like, the food security work coming out of the north, like, the numbers are interesting, like, these kinds of, numbers on food waste are like, okay, that's, like, an interesting place to start, and you can present that as, like, this is a problem, and we know this because of this, but, like, nothing's changing. Nobody, like, goes like, what? And this huge change happens. It's just kind of like, oh,
It's like the same thing with cancer. It's like 3 out of 10 people or whatever the number is, I have no idea. And it's just, it doesn't stop people from smoking. It doesn't stop people from going to the sun, going out in the sun without their, suntan.
Well, no, exactly. And it's because there's no easy solution. Yeah. And I think this is the big thing with a lot of these problems is that this is something that we talk about, like I talk a lot about in the food courses I teach at Concordia. Because I teach food courses in fine arts. Yeah. So we use the arts as a way of, like an artist that used food as a subject, which there's quite a few, as a way of talking about food. And I think it's good because I get a lot of people from science and engineering and like stuff, and it's kind of like, well, we can produce the information, but like, how can we actually really think through this and like come up with other different ways of doing stuff? So I don't know, we'll see. The workshops have been fascinating so far, how people kind of, and partly it's the accessible feature, like even people that are quite good artists, right, but it's that kind of like they're relaxing through it, they're not freaked out over like creating something that's really beautiful and like very perfect and that kind of thing, that it's all playing. Mm-hmm. So we'll see how this one goes. But I'm really interested to see what artists you have and what people are producing, because part of this workshop, I want to use the exhibition as a jump-off point for people to think through speculative art and what it means, kind of thing.
For sure.
This innovation part. So hopefully, the way it's working, hopefully can get in and really start looking at what the artists are producing.
Yeah.
So I can think through that stuff. I mean, for myself, because part of my research is speculative art as a change
culture. I'm curious to what is it about food that inspires you to create art, like, and not be a chef?
No, that's a good question. I think years ago, when I started out, like for instance at the university, I ended up in environmental studies, and we were taught originally that humans were really bad. I took many ecology courses, and I kind of came up with this like, oh my god, we're the worst ever. Humans, just population needs to decrease, and it's really, really bad. But I actually started working on a project with a First Nations community that was within the university area, and I started working with some collaborators of that community that became good friends, and started learning different ways of interacting with the environment, specifically where the university was, and particularly how to restore an ecosystem by using traditional harvesting methods around food. And I was working with a plant called cannas. And so that literally just sort of shifted my idea that like, whoa, wait a second, most of us don't even know this because in Canada we're never taught these things, but there's some pretty important practices around food that actually go with an ecosystem, that work with it. That kind of shifted my interest in food. And then I started looking at food from this kind of way of connecting to the environment on a daily basis. And a lot of those practices, again, fit into the sort of extraordinary, like what we would love to focus on. And I worked also with some organic farmers, and we did sort of videos and different things of documenting what they were doing. But now it's like, well, wait a second. What's the reality in Montreal on a daily basis? I'm not on an organic ranch with like grass-fed cows. I'm not, out like in the field trying to working and understanding cannas. I am in Montreal in an urban space, and what's happening here? Food waste came out of that, which is kind of funny. It's kind of like, something that I was like, ugh, I don't really want to deal with that kind of thing. It's super boring.
Yeah.
It's not that interesting. I'd rather something, you know, more woo, like really fascinating that I wanted to focus on. But it just keeps coming back because, you know, the 1950s to 1970s, that time period is interesting because we started producing mass amounts of food waste after that.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
Like not just edible food waste, but like packaging and wasting energy and all kinds of stuff. So that's interesting. And that's also a part of majority of urban people, right? Like we waste stuff and we do it in a way that we've just, it's very vernacular. It's very normal for us to like throw packaging away. We might recycle it, but it's very normal for us to do those things. So it's kind of getting to a starting point in some way of like what we do or what I do or what other Montrealers are, it's normal for them.
Mm-hmm. And it says, has your practice affected your own like habits with garbage and food waste? Like, has it improved it or has it gotten worse? Like, are you kind of like, oh, I do that for my work, so fuck it.
No, for sure. I mean, like, I think I waste manage at home. I mean, by compost. I've always composted in all kinds of circumstances, and now urban composting where they pick it up.
Mm-hmm.
And before they had the door-to-door, I was doing the Compost Montreal.
Okay.
So definitely composting, I think, is essential because it just feels, like, ridiculous not to.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that is a form of, like, actual greenhouse gases in our landfills. Montreal is one of the worst cities for it. So, yeah, so composting, easy, recycling, easy, you know, trying to minimize what's going into the garbage can. Those are sort of, like, your everyday management things.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's also questioning what's going in there.
Mm-hmm.
Like, why am I buying stuff that has, like, three layers of packages?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And really being more aware of that.
Mm-hmm.
And how, in an urban space, that becomes actually complicated not to do, particularly in Montreal. Like when you go to you buy fruit and it's got the number 6 packaging,
yeah.
And like they're apples.
I mean, I'm always blown away when I go to the grocery store to buy fruits or vegetables and they put it in styrofoam and wrap it in plastic.
Yeah.
I'm like, can
very
we just
common.
Use cardboard?
Yeah.
Then we can at least recycle it.
Yeah. So yeah, number 6 is one of the things that's the most often used if you flip the back of that, and we don't actually recycle that in Montreal right now. They are recyclable, but we don't recycle them. It's one of the only ones we don't do. So those kinds of things, right?
Yeah,
so that's
sort
of a management thing, and I think fundamentally we're questioning like, why do we even do these things? Like what? How did we get to the point that we're wasting so much, whether it's food or materials around food, and there's very logical questions to that we can answer with, you know, like we're moving things around and we don't want the apples to go to waste, so we wrap them up in this thing, and you know those packages cost like 5 cents a piece, so it's easy for them to buy because we ship them in from China.
Yeah,
those are the logical kind of answers. But I think one of the things that's cool about speculative and sort of ways of looking at things is that you want to say, okay, we've got logical answers.
Mm-hmm.
Those logical answers are not actually getting to the, like, really, let's question.
Mm-hmm.
Let's really sort of put that aside and play with those ideas, because that's not something that we have to do. It's what we've become used to doing.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of reasons behind that, but we need to sort of come up with a completely other way of doing something.
Mm-hmm.
And we, to be able to do that, we need to, like, re-understand our values, re-look at like the entire system, and start making. And that's why I think art's so fun, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because you're not writing a report, which I've participated in.
Mm-hmm.
Those reports that say this is how much food we waste per year. This is what you know, how much Montreal wastes. This is those are great to start with.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing with art is you can take that and be like, this is an issue, and then you can start playing with it, and then you can start relating to it differently and move somewhere else with it,
totally.
Which is, I think, really exciting, a part of it, because those information docs, we can completely disassociate from those numbers. Like, what does that really mean?
Yeah.
One-third of the world, the statistics coming out of Food and Agriculture Organization at the UN level is one-third of all food produced we waste, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, that's a huge number, but, like, what does that mean to you or me or you on a daily basis?
Yeah, exactly.
We can completely be like, that's crappy!
Yeah.
You know, we have to figure out how to kind of get into those numbers. So that's why I use 2030 as sort of a playing thing
for
this workshop.
Yeah, well, I was just about to ask you to talk about this workshop that you're giving for the festival.
Yeah, so I mean, for this specific workshop, I'm playing with that number. 2030 is coming up pretty damn fast.
Mm-hmm.
The UN is like, we're going to cut that one-third number in half And who are they targeting? They are targeting Canada. We're one of the worst countries. They're targeting the United States. They're targeting a lot of developed countries, right? There's other developed countries that are doing better than us. Mm-hmm. But they're targeting us, and they're like, you guys really need to fix it. But they're not giving us anything really, like, I mean, you're not, I mean, I'm not hearing that on a daily basis. Nobody's waking me up in the morning and saying, like, you've got to figure something out. Mm-hmm. But they are coming to countries like Canada and saying, okay, so what can we do? Mm-hmm. And you've noticed that, you know, some, I don't know if you've noticed, but some European countries have done things like ban food waste mm-hmm. at the grocery store level, dealt with packaging. That number doesn't come into packaging. I bring packaging into this. That number is specifically edible food waste, something that some humans could consume, mm-hmm. that we're wasting. Mm-hmm. I'm bringing food packaging in and other parts of materials in because I think that's a really important way to view the concept of food waste.
Sure, yeah.
But for that number, that 2030, that is specifically looking at food produce that we could be eating. One third of it's going away, and specifically in developed countries, that is at the household, almost all of it mm-hmm. is at the household level, which I think is really interesting because I would have assumed when you look at the whole food chain that a lot of that's happening at production level or perhaps at the larger grocery store level, but the majority of that, they think, in developing countries, according to the accumulation of research, is household level. That's what we do every day.
Sure.
That's fascinating. Mm-hmm. That's like, you know, what I do, what you do, whatever we do on a daily basis, mm-hmm. that adds up to, like, wasting one third.
I think for me, it's like, and coming from my family, it's like I know that we tend to buy a lot to, like, feed a lot because there's 4 to 5 full mouths to feed.
Yeah.
So, but you kind of, like, we tend to realize too at the end of the week before we do our grocery, it's like, oh, okay, well, we didn't finish that, but it's not good anymore. So.
Yeah, so it has to go.
It has to go.
Yeah, and I think when we, like, I mean, if you have a backyard composter, I think one of the cool things about that is that it really directly is going back into, say, somebody's vegetable garden or something like that, which, you know, is a much more easier cycle to look at, right? You're like, okay, it's going at least to the garden, or if you have chickens or something like that. But yeah, I mean, it's an issue, and it's something that I think is really, it's obviously important, and it also relates to a lot of other interesting things, like the arguing point of distribution. Like, food corporations are creating all kinds of different new models to increase food production. Well, if we're wasting one third of our food, why do we want to increase yields? You know, why do we want to produce genetically modified salmon? You know, we don't need it. Mm-hmm. We don't need it at all.
Yeah.
We need to figure out a completely new way of doing food. And it's not necessarily new. It's born in a lot of old ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Things that, values that we left behind because people told us to leave behind. So, you know, for instance, post-war, being told to get modern, get a fridge, you know, stop buying from your farmer, go to the big grocery stores, live in the suburbs. Like, that entire different model has changed the way we eat. So,
and so what do you think needs to happen in order to push us back into, like, a more sustainable relationship with our food?
Well, I think one of the things, and I think, you know, partly a very side thing of these kinds of workshops that I'm doing, is there's no one solution, right? Mm-hmm. And a lot of the solutions that are presented right now are in critical design, which is partly where I study, affirmative, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, we'll get a better fridge, and that'll be more energy efficient.
Mm-hmm.
We'll get a better waste management system, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we won't throw the plastics in the ocean. We'll just make sure that they're all recycled.
Mm-hmm.
Well, every single one of the solutions that comes from that kind of thinking is just creating problems somewhere else. It's like moving the food waste. It's moving the packaging. It's moving all of those materials and energy. It's not actually saying this entire system is flawed.
Right.
So I'm not saying I have the best solution. I think there's a lot of, there's amazing research that feeds into all kinds of parts of that, right? Like, well, what does local food mean, right? What does it mean when you're buying at a farmer's market? What does it mean when you buy just enough for 2 days? You know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that easy, right? You know what it's like having a family?
Mm-hmm.
Like, going to the grocery store every single day, trying to be, like, super attentive to, like, not wasting, not... It's an entire shift in our lifestyles, but it's also an entire shift of a whole bunch of other things.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's really interesting and important to do different things that we are engaging.
Mm-hmm.
And we're taking, for instance, like, you know, we take these materials and we do different things with them and we think about those materials.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, a workshop I did a couple last month, we were at a festival and I brought all the food packaging and parts of food from that festival mm-hmm. and dumped it on a table. And we made, and the collages that were made from that and different things that were made were really interesting, and the conversations that went with it were fascinating. Mm-hmm. And these weren't food people. These mm-hmm. were people come from all kinds of different things, including artists. But what was interesting was the fact that they were like, oh, I recognize that granola bar box, or I recognize this food package, right? It was like, okay, I see where that came from, mm-hmm. and I see now we're talking about it in a different way, mm-hmm. and I now see that I'm building a weird flower with it onto this collage thing. But it's all of a sudden, it's like taking it out of the norm and then putting it into something else, mm-hmm. not something so alienating mm-hmm. that they can't relate to it, but mm-hmm. something that they're just thinking about it differently. Mm-hmm. And so the conversations come out different. You start understanding something that was, you know, granola bars in a box yesterday, mm-hmm. and now you're like, okay, I'm engaging with this as a potential problem. Mm-hmm. And when there's policies presented by the government, when there's discussions happening around changes to be made, mm-hmm. you're thinking about it. Mm-hmm. Because right now we have a lot of stuff happening, right? Mm-hmm. Way too much mm-hmm. stuff happening. And people need to disassociate to a certain extent because there's a lot of information coming at them. But that's the problem. It's oftentimes information and numbers. And I think when we can relate to stuff differently and then something's presented to society as a way of changing, mm-hmm. you're engaged in that process. Mm-hmm. And so it's not necessarily just about going home and not wasting. Mm-hmm. I think there's a really good argument around the fact that, yes, individual behavior is really important, but there's a lot of stuff happening in the big corporations, there's a lot of stuff happening at the big policy levels that need to change. It's not just about me not wasting. There's entire systems that we need to start shuffling around. The only way we're going to shuffle those things around is if we're aware that they need to be shuffled, or that we understand that there needs to be changes. Mm-hmm. So yes, you can go home and waste less, for sure. But you also want to be engaged in a process that changes stuff. So if policies come up in the government, you know, the national government says, you know, we're going to implement a world, you know, a global distribution, you know, whatever, like in food, and you're like, wait a second, you know, we know that this is happening, or we know that this is happening, or maybe we should be implementing, like, bans on packaging in stores, or, you know, that kind of thing that's already happening in other places. Mm-hmm. You think about it, and you're like, well, maybe this would work in this way.
Sure. Yeah.
It's kind of like that everyday critical design mm-hmm. concepts of how we can make changes, but how it feeds into bigger changes.
Yeah, totally.
If that makes sense.
Totally.
Yeah.
Well, thanks so much for coming and stimulating the conversation.
It's a conversation. Sorry.
No, it was fantastic.
Teaching at Concordia all the time.
Perfect. It was fantastic.
following that excerpt of a conversation with Pamela Touch was Stratus from Caitlin Aurelia Smith's beautiful album Ears. Today here at Pirate Block Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM, we are pulling out content from past seasons. For our next segment here, we'll have a jump in time to a covering of the Biopolitics event series and a third exhibition of the series with the theme Food Control, here reflected upon through a conversation with Norwegian artist Signe Lidén.
Hello, you're tuned in to Eastern Bloc, Pirate Bloc Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM. Today we have a special guest with us, Signe Lidén from Norway, who has presented a work entitled Ivagturen. I'm sure she will pronounce it much better than I have. She has presented a piece and a part of our biopolitics series, and it's one of my favorite pieces that's been at the block in the past during this biopolitics series. So, Signe, welcome to Pirate Block Radio.
Thank you.
So I wanted to ask you if you could give a brief synopsis of your project and your background as an artist.
I'm a Norwegian artist, and I've been based in Bergen the last years. Been also living for some time in Germany, and work mainly with sound in various ways, and always connected to place. And this project, that this Ivagturen is a part of, it's called the Cold Coast Archive. And it's a project that takes this global seed vault at Spitsbergen as its focal point. And we created, it's an online project, and it's also various, we had been having two exhibitions, but also a lot of these different other works that is, in a way, it's a part of the project, but also has its own life, like Ivagturen, which is this long-term mechanical sculpture that records activity in the seed vault into eternity.
Beautiful, beautiful. So how did you first discover the Global Seed Vault? How did you hear about it?
Well, I was contacted by an artist called Steve Rowell while I was living in Berlin, and he had done a lot of projects with the Center of Land Use Interpretation. Mm-hmm. I think it's called the Center of Land Use Interpretation. I got a bit unsure now, he wanted to do a project on the Global Seed Vault or about it, and it was very open. Mm-hmm. And we had a chat, and I was in the beginning a bit critical because I thought, it's such a huge project in itself, so how can I do an art project?
Had you heard about it prior to him contacting you?
I had heard about it, but at that point I thought it was a great idea in itself. But I had not really thought of doing a project about it. Yeah.
It's super. I think some people are surprised when you tell them that this place exists. Can you explain, like, to the listeners, what is this Global Seed Vault and what's its purpose?
The Global Seed Vault, it's located far north, almost on the North Pole, in this archipelago called Spitsbergen. And the island of Svalbard, or the island of Spitsbergen, but on Svalbard. And it's actually the idea about the Global Seed Vault. Prior to the Global Seed Vault, it was a 100-year project, which is The Norgen, the seed bank in the Nordic countries, they stored in one of the old coal mines up there in the permafrost. They stored a container full with seeds, mm-hmm. which they sealed in, I think it was in late 80s, mm-hmm. and it's supposed to be opened then 100 years later. Mm-hmm. And I think that was the beginning of thinking Spitsbergen as a location for a global backup system for seeds. So it's safety duplicates of seeds from seed banks all over the world that are stored there far into the mountains in this secure and cold place. Mm-hmm. It's supposed to be, yeah, really a backup system in terms of, in case of these large scale catastrophes, as epidemies or like war. Like we have an example now in Syria, and this is the first time it actually seeds has been taken out from the wall again, because the seed banks in Syria have been destroyed because of the war, mm-hmm. and then they have been picking up their seeds from the vault, and then have new projects in Lebanon and also in Morocco to create new holdings in the seed banks there, and then also sent back to the vault when they have enough themselves.
So, do you know what kind of seeds are in these vaults? Is it like stuff that we think is pretty normal, or?
Yeah, it's only food crops, but and I think it's everything you can think of when it comes to maize or corn and different. Wheat and all these things we used to like in food. Yeah. Oh, that was not the best answer.
No, that's fine. That makes sense.
It's food crops.
Yes, food crops. Yeah, I mean that makes total sense. I was just wondering if there was something that was there that maybe is already kind of starting to go extinct or that is starting to become like hard to find that we would think normal.
Yeah, well, it's quite complicated because the process of seed breeding, it's a constant process of developing the seeds. Mm-hmm. And I think some of the very, for example, the very old Nordic crops, they are stored there, which have not been cultivated really for a long time, mm-hmm. and it's only there's no commercial business of farmers who are using this, but it's actually quite important that they are there in case a epidemic or virus spread in mm-hmm. in, and you can go back kind of for some centuries and start again this process.
Yeah, definitely. So for this project, you constructed a sound device. Can you talk about that and explain to the listeners the best that's possible, since we can't show them a photo of what it is?
Well, the very first idea was to make some kind of instrument that I thought a live instrument connected to this web page where the Colcos archive is an ongoing online exhibition. Mm-hmm. And I thought of first doing an instrument that could be streamed there based on the data of the conditions of the seeds. Mm-hmm. I must admit, when I started to work on that, it got a bit boring because it's not much happening.
Right.
And also, it's I like to make very material things and very object-based. And I thought to actually create object would stimulate the imagination much more, and also that it's this record coming one after one each year.
Right.
Yeah, but back to your question, it's how it is, what it actually is. It's a mechanical instrument based on a very early recording in technique, mm-hmm. Just with a cone, with a needle that when... So the idea is that when the door is opening, then the whole mechanical construction starts. Mm-hmm. And then it's a record turning around, and then needle record the sounds which are captured in the cone.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, it's also captures this... It's a Tibetan ball on top, and okay. It's also a very resonant plate, which forms some kind of rhythmic repetition.
Yeah.
And then you vaguely hear some of the surrounding sounds also.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. I was wondering, because I wasn't sure exactly what was all built in the device, and I've been listening to it for the past 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So that's it's very interesting that that's how it's created. So it's basically like a lathe.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's super interesting. And so this arts organization, they had contact with the Global Seed Vault, and that's how you were able to get in there and install this?
Yeah, well, we started out the year when the vault was opening. That's when Steve contacted me, and we worked on the planning of the project for a while. I think even 2 years before mm-hmm. we spent first him and then and also Alexander Rose together with him. He's from he created the World Clock mm-hmm. at the Longnow Foundation. Alexander Rose from the Longnow Foundation. Mm-hmm. And they had the first field trip and then did quite a lot of survey that Anne-Sophie Norden and I used when we did the field trip, and then also that I did when I was creating this instrument.
So what was your initial goal for the project? And has it changed since?
My initial goal, it's a hard question. For me, it's to really turn out to be a project when I started to think of this long-term thinking and places connected to long-term thinking. And I think maybe if you ask for a goal, I think to create an object that can stimulate and trigger the thought of long-term thinking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well,
inspired by the seed vault itself. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, to create a device that is recording, I guess, consistently it produces a record every year, essentially.
Yeah.
Okay. That's and so a year is condensed onto 33 and a third.
Yeah.
that's pretty beautiful for all the vinyl freaks out there, you know.
Yeah.
What I wanted to talk about was this long-term thinking that you just brought up.
Yeah.
So, I guess how does one plan? How did these scientists that were down there, or farmers, I suppose, as well, plan for this long-term thinking, and how did you were you inspired how were you inspired to integrate that into your piece?
Well, as in this, I interviewed also Roland von Bottmer, who's the information director of the Global Seed Vault, but he's also professor of genetics and seed breeding. Mm-hmm. And he explained me that the extremely long-term thinking, which is embedded in seed breeding itself, and so the whole not only the place itself and the time that this place is dealing with, or the time scale, but also the seed breeding itself is a really, it's a long-term thinking project. So I think it's for the people who are involved, were involved with creating this, it's they're quite trained in thinking generations and generations and generations, mm-hmm. and that some of the changes one might do now will be visible or change something in 150 years, for example.
Yeah.
But here, I think, I don't know many other places in the world which deals with this long-term process of keeping, storing, but also maintaining something for such a long time. Do you?
Well, the only thing I can think of is there's like National Archives for Film, where there's like preservation of film, which is also like something that can deteriorate over time, but nothing that's so interesting that it can be reused and reharvested. And you know what I mean? Like essentially this type of preservation the whole idea of the vault is just stimulating by thinking that we're preserving these seeds, which can then feed our children and our children's children.
Yeah.
You know, like it's an amazing sort of investment that is being happening up there.
Yeah. And then that is a backup. I think that's, sorry. Am I out now?
No, you're here.
Okay.
Yeah.
Suddenly it looked like I was off. Then you have to cut again.
It's okay.
Can you ask the question again?
I don't remember. What did I ask?
Oh, yeah.
I have just responded to one of your questions.
Yeah, this long-term, I want to say... it was, this generation, food for generation and generation.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
Now I'm back on track. Yeah, and I think that's a very important thing, that this is really, it's a very low-key thing. Actually, it's just a freezer, huge freezer with frozen seeds. And, but it's, that is... That's placed it. Up there, but it's also that it's this backup in case of this large scale catastrophes. I think that's what make it kind of so huge as a thought.
Yeah. Is there concern about us making too many withdrawals from the vault? Like, is there like a limit that they say, like, we can only withdraw like a total of 5 times a year in order to keep this functioning?
Well, actually, until now, it has only been withdrawn seed once, and that's for the Syrian seed bank. But there's seed deliveries there up to 5 times per year, I think, or I think never more than 10 times. And I try to limit it to open up the seed vault also because of temperature changes and all this.
Right. That makes sense.
Yeah. Mm. So.
Well, this has been a great conversation. So, Signe, thank you very much for joining us. Thanks for being on Pirate Block Radio, and we wish you all the best.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And those were the sounds from Canadian composer Tim Hecker with the track Obsidian Counterpoint. This launches us into the last segment of the day, which is a focus on the collective SUSE technology and a conversation together with one of the co-founders, Milo Reinhardt.
Thanks for coming on the show, Milo.
Thanks, Tatum.
Do you want to tell us a bit how SUSE technology came to be, first of all?
Yeah, sure. So the project was founded by Teo Zamudio and myself in 2015. It was kind of like a collaborative exchange that was centered around making electronic music and experimenting with design and visuals and projections. And it's since evolved to include Kat and Xavier, who are also producing music and art on the label. Yeah.
How did you and Teo come to meet?
Teo moved back to Montreal and landed at a house of friends that I was very close with, and we had just been in contact online prior to him moving and started our friendship there. He came to me and it was really quick. I guess he and I have been working kind of inseparably since he arrived. I think that was, I don't know, 2010. I'm not very good at those dates, but early on we were working together on visuals and projections for a previous project that Xavier and I had, Sibian and Fawn, and we did a few of our first shows then, actually, so that would have been like 2013 at the SAT for MuTech, but that was kind of like an old configuration of something similar. So since it's grown into SUSE.
So what's each of your roles collaboratively? How do you work?
It is really like a lot of back and forth. Like each of us kind of stand our own as contributors to the project. And in many ways, Teo and I have in founding the project directed early on some of the trajectory and just developing the project to also include other artists has been like really important. Sorry, what was the question?
No, let's just go on. What appeals to you and drives you to make digital art instead of physical art? Like, what inspires your form that you do?
Okay, yeah, I would just specify that we also do make physical work. My practice is grounded in like a studio-based practice, but a lot of the work that we've been doing with Susie and like the research and creative projects we've been doing with Susie have been primarily digital works. And I think for me, like a lot of that is just reflective of how my workflow has evolved, especially in relation to music, like the infinite possibilities that I experience working in like a digital audio work phase are kind of paralleled in video and like other forms that I'm working with. So in a lot of ways, it's kind of like a necessary reflection of the range and like scope of ideas that I've been exploring and that others have been exploring. I've wanted to, with my own digital production, explore that same range of expression or visual experimentation that we're able to explore in like limitless like sonic field.
Do you have a process or like a starting point, maybe a certain source material you use musically or visually?
Yeah, typically with Susie, we've been like assembling projects as releases and then around performances. And then within those performances, we have video work. We have been developing like a video archive for the last 3 years that we've been working together. So for the video components, often what we're doing is actually like drawing from these small experiments and then kind of reconfiguring them to build a new multi-dimensional narrative that kind of like pulls from all of the assets and all of our creative exchanges. Not necessarily equally, like sometimes the performance or the project demands the creation of original material as well. Every performance that we've done to date has presented original music and original video. Yeah, a lot of work actually does go into starting the projects and kind of defining conceptually like what direction we want to take and what this music evokes and how that can be reflected in video work as well. And there's a lot of work to be done, actually. A lot of the material that we have developed thus far, everyone has had like visuals developed for their performances, whether it was at the SAT for the dome projections that we did, or at New Tech, or like more recently at the NVA show. Like, yeah, each of us has had the opportunity to kind of like shape the interplay between the audio and the visual together. But primarily, Teo and I are developing the video work, but with collaborative input from Kat and Xavier.
A few weeks ago, you guys played a party at Eastern Block in collaboration with Neverpart. What do you think of parties as an exhibition space, or like, you know, showing your work at a party versus like at an installation in an art gallery? Is there a different narrative there in that sense?
Well, a lot of us have made a lot of music that we haven't shared, and we've tried more and more to be experimental in our approach to the audiovisual presentations and showcases that we've done. Like, our sound is very influenced by dance music and club music, though, and a lot of our presentation opportunity are in those venues and in that context. But ultimately, like, that experience is fed into the music and is fed into the video, and I think it's an important part of what we do. It's like an honest part of what we do. It's not fully extracted from what it is. It's if it were in a white cube, yeah, you'd be looking in on it, maybe, as opposed to experiencing it for what it is in this form. That's not to say that Susie isn't interested in presenting work in a more traditional like gallery context. It's just like at this stage, what we're doing with music has situated in venues and in clubs, and what we're doing with the visual side of things is just trying to like push the boundaries and like make a real connection between the sound and video and viewer, basically.
It's definitely an interesting, like, dichotomy, though, because you have this dark and spacious music paired with, like, big data and, you know, death and the internet, that kind of thing. But you still have people partying along to these ideas.
I think it's just, like, important, or it's an opportunity, and I think more and more we're looking for opportunities to, like, speak in more and more direct ways on the things we are engaged with, the things that affect us, that concern us. And I think that context, like, people coming together, it's just almost, like, unexpected in some ways that, I don't know, I mean, not necessarily, but we do try to reflect our world, or, like, our experience and our processing of everything that's going on, and it's just a means to share. I think the visual narrative for Susie is about to really open wide, and we'll be able to actually trace more narratives through some of, like, the visual chronology that we're developing, I guess.
Where do you want Susie to be in the future, like a few years from now, a few months from now?
I want to continue to develop Susie as a project that does center itself around being an artist collective, and that's one of the things that I think most importantly we're trying to negotiate and, like, understand and learn in the future. Like, I definitely hope to be working with more artists and connecting our work, hopefully, to an international audience, because we're very excited about the work and passionate about the work that we're doing, and we're just starting out, and it's going to be exciting to really, like, share everything that we've been, like, pouring our hearts into with those that are willing to get it.
Well, I'm really excited to see where it goes, man.
Yeah, definitely. And I guess more concretely, we have releases planned for December, which I'm very excited about. We'll be posting about that stuff soon. I can plug the website, www.susy.technology. You can check out our current releases and some video from performances as well. We'll have updates on new releases coming in December on our Facebook page.
Thanks for coming on, man.
Thank you very much.
That, folks, was all for this dive into the archives of Pirate Block Radio. We have heard segments containing discussions with Pamela Tudge, Signe Liden, and Milo Reinhardt. As of next month, a brand new season of the show kicks off, filled to the brim with new content on and around digital practices, inventive tools, and technology in media art and related fields. So stay tuned for that, same place, same time, here at CKUT 90.3 FM, Pirate Block Radio, with me, Malte Leander. Stay safe and catch you soon.
Merci beaucoup, Mme Saint-Onge. On a fait l'intro de Francis et les exerciceurs sur les ondes de CKUT Radio McGill.
Je voulais t'acheter un bouquet de fleurs pour faire plaisir à ton 4 heures. Au lieu des fleurs, ce furent des pleurs. moi, j'en avais gros sur le cœur. On a fini par se disputer, on a crié, on a pleuré, on a pesté.
Pas le sou, pas le sou, on n'a pas le sou.